Hey everyone, Adam D. from Indefensive Ska here. A little note before we start the show. Los Angeles is dealing with multiple catastrophic fires. A lot of people have lost their homes and are in need. If you're able to help, please do so. There are a lot of great organizations you can donate to, like California Fire Foundation, Pasadena Humane Society, Mutual Aid LA, and there's even a list of people in the music industry that have lost their homes. Links are in the show notes for our Rob Harvilla episode. Thanks.
Save big money on everything for your next bathroom project. Now at Menards. Upgrade your bathroom with Max. With more than 1,000 showers, bathtubs, and surrounds, you're sure to find exactly what you need to add luxury and style to your bathroom. Save big on our entire selection of Max bathroom products. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Taxes was feeling so stuck. Sitting in traffic, squeezing into a parking spot, all to squeeze in getting tax help during your lunch break. Now Taxes is a TurboTax expert who does your taxes for you, while you go about your day getting real-time notifications about their progress and the most money back guaranteed. Now this is Taxes, Intuit TurboTax. Get an expert now on TurboTax.com. Only available with TurboTax Live Full Service, real-time updates only in iOS mobile apps. See guarantee details at TurboTax.com/guarantees.
Consequence Podcast Network. This is In Defense of Ska. Our mission is to document the ska scene from its traditional roots through until its emergence as a diverse global genre. The influence of ska resonates through your favorite bands and artists in ways you might have missed. I am your co-host, Adam D., of Omnigon and Asian Man Records band Link 80. Joining me is your host, Aaron Carnes, renowned author of the book In Defense of Ska, which is currently available in an expanded second edition.
Adam, I have some news for you.
Okay.
Smash Mouth just released a ska song last November.
Amazing. What is it?
Yeah, it's a ska cover of the Beatles' Love Me Do.
Love, love me do. You know.
Not what I had on my 2025 or 2024 checklist, but okay.
Yeah, so I thought this would be a great opportunity to talk about Smash Mouth and the relationship to ska, because it's been quite a while since they put out a new ska song, but in their early years, they did quite a bit of ska punk, so let's kind of discuss that.
Yeah.
So first things first, who are Smash Mouth, you're asking?
Yeah.
Well, they formed in San Jose, California in 1994. Their first record, Fa Shu Meng, was released in 1997. It was recorded independently, but the recording got them a deal with Interscope Records. Their 60s garage pop song, Walking on the Sun, was a huge hit. It went to number one on the Billboard Modern Rock Tracks chart. It was on radio and MTV for quite a while. After that, they got even bigger with their second record and songs like All Star. For this episode, we want to focus on their first record and the years leading up to it, since it was the era that Smash Mouth played a fair amount of ska punk. To do that, we're talking to bassist and only original member still in the band, Paul Delisle.
So I saw Smash Mouth one time before they were big, and they were definitely a ska punk band.
Yeah, so this is the conversation behind the conversation we're having.
Yeah.
Should we consider them a ska band or not? And yeah. Listen to the episode and see what you think. Make up your mind.
All right. And now let's talk to Paul.
So in November, you released a ska cover of Love Me Do by the Beatles.
Yeah.
Is this the first ska song you've put out since your first record?
I think so, probably.
Yeah, I think as far as I could tell, yeah.
Well, you know, it was for this, you know, this punk rock Valentine's record.
Well, originally it was supposed to be punk rock Beatles.
Punk rock Beatles, yeah. And so the idea was to do it, and I just thought it would be funny just to not, you know, to just try it, like, I just heard it like that, like a ska punk way, and then sort of, you know, slowing it down a bit in the bridges, and it gets a little repetitious, but The whole idea was just to do it some just different from the original. You know, that's the main goal, just as long as it's, because that song in particular, if you listen to it, there's not a lot of dynamic in it. And at the time of its release, it wasn't a huge hit, you know, like it was, I think it got to number 17 and, you know, at the time of its release, and it kind of just sort of plods along, you know, the original song, Love Me Do, like Love Me Do. So I thought, well, we got to pick it up a little bit at least, but I thought it came out pretty cool.
Yeah. That's funny to hear that it wasn't really a hit in the time, because I remember I had an experience when I was in my 20s where I was eating at a kind of a nice Italian restaurant in Santa Cruz. I was on a date, and most people there were like older, like kind of the era that probably grew up with the Beatles. And that song came on, like on the overhead, whatever. And the whole place, everyone there went crazy. They just started singing along. It was like the song they'd always wanted to hear, like, came on, and they all sang along. It was so surreal.
Well, of course, it became a, after, you know, the Ed Sullivan Show, of course it was a big hit then. Everything they,
yeah.
But at the initial release, that was their very first single was Love Me Do.
Yeah.
When they were signed to Capitol. So, but you know what I mean? The original is kind of like the beat's almost like, it's not like a country song, but it's kind of like love me do. It's almost like a waltz or something, you know. It just kind of flick, and it just stays in that same key. It doesn't modulate and everything, and it's the same beat, but it's not their typical rockin' beat like on She Loves You or Please Me or like the, you know, their next singles. So I thought the reason why that I wanted to do Love Me Do was, it seemed like that was the one, therefore, that had the most potential to make it different. I mean, what are you going to do with, you know, Eleanor Rigby or, like, you know, or Yesterday, right? How are you going to make that better? With Love Me Do, that one seemed like more of an open canvas. So I thought, what the hell? Let's pick it up a bit and, like, do it more like punk style. And, like, love me do, but, you know, I just kind of heard it like that. And then,
so just for clarity, you were the one that said, let's make this a punk ska version.
It was pretty much my arrangement, yeah. But Randy, our drummer, he's, you know, he's a musical director along with me. He's been in the band a lot of time. And so he had an idea that was similar. And so we kind of... did it together a little bit, but yeah, it was mostly my arrangement. I got to take a blame for it. Oh, and of course, Deegan, my partner in recording over here, Deegan Adams, he had a lot to do with it. And we're actually in the studio right now recording at the moment.
Oh yeah. Are any more ska songs?
Not at the moment.
You could always change one. You could make one ska, you know?
Here, come on in here and say hi. I got to introduce you. This is Deegan Adams. He's the Smash Mouth producer. I mean, we're in San Jose recording here at Sound Management Studios.
Where in San Jose is that?
We're near Campbell. We're in San Jose. We're near the corner. It's on Winchester, and it's kind of in a bit like a world. It's the only like house here. It's a house, but Robert, our manager, Robert Hayes, you know, 20 some years ago, turned this house into an office and with a complete functioning recording studio. I don't know if you can see this.
Oh yeah, it's a real legit recording studio.
Yeah,
yeah. And this is where we do. And Deegan is our engineering, and I live here in San Jose, so you know I'm here a lot.
Okay, but we got to know though, Paul. How far away are you from Taco Bravo right now?
Okay, how far away from Bravo? We're about. Definitely within, it's a long walk. We're like a mile away. Yeah, that's on Bascom. We're on
long walk, short drive.
It's you go down Hamilton and it's, yeah, Taco Bravo. It's like, if you live here, you know, you might go to Bravo once a year or two. Bravo's like the best food and the worst food at the same time.
Yes, we agree 100%. We love talking about Taco Bravo.
Yeah, we grew up in Gilroy, so.
Oh, okay.
We have been to Bravo many, many times.
All right. Yeah. Where are you guys?
I'm in Sacramento. Adam's in Alameda.
Oh, okay, cool. All right. So it's a little better. Come on over.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
We're like, it's right by the corner of Winchester and Hamilton. There's like a Burger King on the corner there. And then a Walgreens, and it's a pretty major crossroads there. And then it's like Angie's Pizza and markets and stuff. But there's one house on Winchester, and that's the Smash Mouth headquarters.
I'm stoked to hear you're still in San Jose. What's kept you in San Jose?
A lot of things, you know. First of all, this is where we're from, you know, and this is where I'm from. I'm from Mountain View. My parents still live in Mountain View. They're getting older. They're like, you know, 88, 90 years old. So they're in Mountain View. So I like being close to them. My sister's in Cupertino. And my daughter's in Aptos. So it's, there's, you know, I have no, desire to move to LA or Nashville, which is like the hip thing to do these days. No, thank you. You know,
yeah.
No offense to either of those places, but you know, I don't know if I could handle the weather in Nashville.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, in the history of rock and roll, there's only been a few bands, big bands, that have hailed from San Jose. I mean, there's Doobie Brothers.
Yeah.
Smash Mouth.
Yeah, that's
that's the short list.
There's also like the Count Five. You remember the Count Five? I got it. Action. That was a big hit.
I used to work at a 7-Eleven. I used to work at a 7-Eleven in San Jose because I did live in San Jose for a while.
Which 7-Eleven?
Kind of by the university, right off of 280.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was a member of that band that used to always come in, and we used to like chat all the time about music. It was really weird.
Really cool.
Yeah.
and you know, like Tom Johnson, before he started, wasn't Moby Grape kind of a little bit from San Jose too? Like sort of.
Maybe, yeah, yeah. But we're glad that you're still repping San Jose.
I love San Jose. This is home. This is where the band is from, and this is where our office is, and this is where we've had the same manager for 30 years, you know, Robert Hayes, Sound Management here. So, and Ron Exposed and D, and you know, it's the same guys, and it works great. I don't see any reason to move, you know. I like it here. And, yeah, here I'll stay. This is where business is, and it's, you know, everyone's, it's all good. We're lucky.
So your first record, I want to talk about your first record. Do you pronounce it Fushumang?
Fushumang, yeah.
Okay. I was re-listening.
I just liked hearing Aaron try to pronounce it.
Yeah, I know. It was very tentative.
Greg and Steve said to each other, hey, Fushumang.
I know it's taken from Scarface. I know that's the reference, but I still, you know, I felt very tentative.
But the thing is, if you watch the movie Scarface, nowhere in the movie does anyone ever say that. that wasn't my idea. I thought it was kind of a dumb title, to be honest with you.
I was re-listening to the record, and of the 12 original tracks, I know there's an extended version now, but of the 12 original tracks, I would say half of them. Six of them have some kind of ska or ska element to it. The other thing I was going to add is that I saw you guys play, like, we're from Gilroy, and then when I was a young adult, I moved to San Jose. So we were always
the band Salmon.
Oh yeah,
yep, yeah. I grew up with those guys. Absolutely know those guys. I knew their old band called Dutch Courage.
Aaron's like the same age as those guys.
But I saw Smash Mouth play at the Cactus Club, opening for Voodoo Glow Skulls. This was before you had a song on the radio. I don't know if you had a deal at that point.
Okay, can I ask you a question? I don't mean to interrupt, but this is pertinent to what you're saying. Do you remember a band called Lackadaddy?
Oh, yes, I do. And you and Greg were in that band, right?
Yes, Greg and I, that was Greg and I's band right before Smash Mouth, yeah.
Yeah, so Lackadaddy were like kind of like punk, but also kind of rap.
More like Rage Against the Machine, more like Salmon. It was more like a funk punk, like Beastie Boys kind of thing, trying to be like,
yeah, yeah.
With a real drummer, like, ranting and chanting, you know.
So what caused you guys to transition from Lackadaddy, like a more like punk with hip-hop sound, to a ska punk band?
First of all, our drummer kept, you know, refusing, like, not showing up for rehearsals and gigs, and that was really important. But we were doing well, you know. We actually sold out the Cactus Club a couple times, you know, like, as Lackadaddy, there was label interest. But Greg and I were, you know, were musical partners no matter what we did. And we both wanted to Lackadaddy was fun, but it was a one trick pony, and it was not built to last. You know what I mean? It was kind of like we're trying to be a Beastie Boys thing, but it was more like a Limp Bizkit thing. It was funny. You know, it was kind of hard metal with, you know, it was trendy or whatever. So and Greg was a songwriter, you know, like, and he could write, he started everything, but in Lackadaddy, he wasn't even playing guitar. And then we had one meeting, I remember one day, and we'd known Steve. I had known Steve for like a year or so. And Greg didn't know I knew him, but that's another story. And we had this meeting over lunch, and I remember the guitar player in Lackadaddy, he goes, well, and we weren't sure what to do. He goes, well, I think since I'm the guitar player in the band, I should be the songwriter. So I think I should, I'm going to write all the songs from here on in. And I was just like, wow, thanks. Thanks for doing that, man. Dinner over, you just made lunch over. You just made my decision for me. And Greg and I'm like, thanks for doing that, man. We'll be leaving now. You know, because you're in a band with Greg demanding that you write the songs. I'm like, thanks. No way. We'll be leaving now. And so Greg and I went and started doing special with Steve and Kevin, you know.
Yeah. So Steve was in a band. Or he was a rapper, right? He was in the thing called.
Smash Mouth was his first band. He was a rapper before that, like,
yeah.
And out of the gates, he had a kind of a hit. I mean, he was. Greg and I were impressed. You know, we were like, how did this guy do this? Like, out of nowhere, he had that song, Big Black Boots. It was a total ripoff of Everlast Family, House of Pain, you know. Mm-hmm. It was totally that. I don't know if you heard that song, Big Black Boots. Kicking down the doors with my big black boots, you know. It was Greg and I thought it was a cool song, and we wanted to play it in Smash Mouth, but Steve never would. He would never let us play it in Smash Mouth. But anyways, that you know, we were impressed that this guy had a record deal. We didn't know that, you know. We didn't know that he couldn't sing, but we quickly found that. No, Steve was like, wait, you had a, am I diverting from the question here? I tend to do that.
This is all relevant. We're talking kind of like, what we're curious about is like, you guys were in a rap rock band. Steve was basically a rapper,
right?
So how did we go into ska punk?
Okay. For Greg and I, that was like, the way we were writing songs together, we had the same musical taste, you know. We were skateboarders and surfers and we just liked the same things, and we went back, and there was that little bit, that ska thing was kind of happening a little bit in you know, with Goldfinger and those bands that like Less Than, you know, kind of the third wave, whatever it was. But we always dug that music from high school, like especially like the Specials and like English Beat. So we were doing, you know, we decided to write like pop songs, but they came out like pop punk. We were trying to be like a surf, more of a surf band, like surf punk band, just, you know, just whatever the songs were, they were. We didn't really plan it, you know, that much. And the ska thing was just kind of fun to do in these pop songs we had, not all of them, but, you know, it sounded cool in rehearsal, and we dug it. And so we just incorporated it in those songs. But we didn't get like hung up on it. That wasn't like the whole thing. Mm-hmm. But it worked within our, you know, whatever our genre or whatever we were trying to be, which was just songs, you know, just, you know. And so when we started with Steve, what happened with Steve and Kevin was, here's the thing, they were absolute rookies. Like Steve was like, we didn't know, you know, what to make of him. I remember after our first rehearsal, I was like, when's the drummer going to get here? You know? And Greg's like, after they finally left, we had to rehearse in Greg's bedroom at his house on South Morrissey in San Jose. And after Greg and Steve finally left, you know, he's like, well, what do you think? I'm like, well, the big fellow can't seem to carry a tune in a handbasket. And any singer looking guy I've ever seen, and I'm pretty sure I saw a gun, and and he's frightening and scary, and then I also think he's great. And Greg agreed with me. He knew what I meant. Like, he's also, he can't sing. He doesn't look like a lead. But he's, somehow he's great. Like, you know, and Greg agreed. So then we spent, you know, the next 2.5 years, like, defending him. When you're playing in a band with that guy, you know, like.
Yeah. What is, it's like charisma, right? Cause I was rewatching.
It was so much charisma, and he could sing. He really could. Steve could sing, man. He got better. And once he got the hang of how to, you know, actually use a mic in a PA system, we rehearsed every day. We did rehearse. They were very, him and Kevin were very gung ho and very serious, and they were criminals. So they had money. I'm sorry. I didn't say that, but it's true. So. I'm in control for that. But, you know, it was great fun. And when really I just loved Steve and Greg. We were all best friends. Like, you know, I thought Steve was the greatest guy in the world, man. So did Greg. Greg and I were already musical partners, you know, and we were already best friends. But Steve came along and he was like this, it was like the bully guy, the jock guy in high school that would kick your ass or flush your head down the toilet, is all of a sudden on your side. You know,
that's yeah. I was rewatching some of like the early Smash Mouth videos, like Walking on the Sun. And if you follow them, maybe out tomorrow, but if we out the sun, you might as well be walking on the sun. And I kind of brought me back to that time. It's like, he doesn't look like what you expect someone on MTV to look like, but he carries himself with so much confidence that it completely works.
I remember once, like, I was sitting out, not to be all like Mr. Hollywood, we were sitting out at the pool by the shadow of Marmot, whatever. And I was sitting with his, at the time, wife, Michelle. We were sitting by the pool watching Steve, and he's swimming, and he's like doing this thing he did. I don't know what to do. But she's like, she goes to me, she goes, He's somehow kind of beautiful, isn't he? You know, I'm like, yeah. Like he was. Steve was kind of beautiful in a way back in the, you know, like I have older sisters who both thought that he was like, well, he's kind of sexy. I'm like, no, well, you can't say that. You know, children loved him. You know, when my daughter was five or six, she'd you know, go to it, you know, or tell me and her, you know, my parents are grandparents. Steve's my boyfriend. And we're like, no, he's not.
So Lack of Daddy was you and Greg. I remember before Lack of Daddy, Greg was in a band called Heroic Airmen.
Heroic Airmen. Yeah, I liked Heroic Airmen. They were cool.
So this is, you weren't in that band, right? This was
no, I was Go Man Go, which was like more of a Palo Alto band, mm-hmm. kind of cover, kind of lame original band, you know, but it was more of a cover band. But I liked all those. Like, Heroic Airmen was a good one.
Yeah.
I liked them. I liked, you remember, like Frontier Wives and Drake?
Frontier Wives were that was my favorite late 80s San Jose band.
Yeah, with Lex, you know. And
Lex, yeah.
Scott Long. Scott passed away a couple years ago, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But there was other great bands, too. Like remember Dot 3?
Mm-hmm, Dot 3. They were, like, kind of a weird funk rock band.
I went to junior high school with that guy, with Ken Chick, and high school with that guy, and San Jose State with him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know. It's a slightly before my time, but I know all those guys. I know that whole scene that came before my time. And it's a cool scene. There was a place called the Laundry Works where those bands, this is like pre-Cactus Club, yeah.
Yeah. And there were some good bands too, like Whistling Bullets, you know, they were good too.
Mm-hmm.
Songs, you know, they had good songs. And you know who else was really good? You remember the Odd Numbers?
Odd Numbers, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
They kind of continued on, so they were in my era as well. And they still play. They're still a good band, yeah.
Yeah, they actually still play.
You know, in the 72, during 95, I remember, like, Salmon was, like, kind of huge. Like, they were, like, selling
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
Everyone thought they were going to be famous and get signed, you know.
They did get signed, but then after they got signed, it kind of just didn't really go anywhere. You know, just the story of many bands in the 90s.
Yeah, they were kind of on the new metal trip a little bit.
In Defense of Ska will return in a moment.
Taxes was feeling so stuck. Sitting in traffic, squeezing into a parking spot, all to squeeze in getting tax help during your lunch break. Now Taxes is a TurboTax expert who does your taxes for you. while you go about your day getting real-time notifications about their progress and the most money back guaranteed. Now this is taxes. Intuit TurboTax. Get an expert now on TurboTax.com. Only available with TurboTax Live Full Service. Real-time updates only in iOS mobile apps. See guarantee details at TurboTax.com/guarantees.
Owning a boat comes with a number of perks, like being able to say, ahoy, or land ho, and not feel weird about it. So here's another perk. GEICO's boat insurance offers access to the largest towing fleet on the water. And with specialist support from agents that are as passionate about boating as you are, there's so much value that you'll want to say, shiver me timbers, and not feel weird about that either. Get more with GEICO.
Big shout out to you for making it through the hectic holiday season. This new year, get clean, quality, pregnancy nutrient support off your to-do list, including Ritual's best-selling essential prenatal multivitamin, designed with 12 traceable key ingredients to support a healthy pregnancy. With big changes coming up, take the small steps now and start today with 30% off a 3-month supply at ritual.com/podcast. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
What I recall, and I would get your curious your take on this, is it sounds to me like you guys really grinded hard. You guys, but before you got signed, you guys were working real hard. You were playing. You were trying to do showcases. You were anything you could do to kind of get your music out there.
We did, because we weren't that young, to be honest with you. And for me, it was kind of a last hurrah. So we did rehearse every day for for about 2 years. That's a fact. We didn't, because Greg and I, back then you could make a living in cover bands. And I was in a cover band called Skeleton Crew, and he was in a cover band called The Gents. And you could make like $2,000 or $2,500 or $3,000 a month. Now it doesn't seem like a lot now, but back then, fuck dude, rent was like $350, my PTO had a car. What else, like we could make a living doing that. So we had our days free. So Greg and I worked, he was in The Gents, who was like the most popular cover band in San Jose. I don't know if you remember them. They were an excellent, excellent cover band. And anyways, we made our living that way. Now, Kevin and Steve, on the other hand, they said that they were house painters. They said that they painted them. Like, did they paint them at midnight? Because they sure as hell had all their days free. Okay. What do you mean you're house painters? Okay. Turns out they were criminals, but they were handy guys to have around, because they could pay for rehearsal places. They would pay for studio time if we had to do dinners. We needed pictures. They always had money, And then Greg and I were so naive, we didn't realize that, they were very motivated with the band thing too. I got to give Steve and Kevin credit for that. We all were like, when we went to make the first record, we were super well rehearsed at all those songs. Like we've been playing those songs for a couple of years, and we were ready to, those songs were well rehearsed. I think it kind of comes out on the record, because we weren't signed. We made that record. We made it in I think we had 9 days or 10 days, and that's not a lot of time to do 12 songs, and try to make it like major label level. But we had Eric Valentine too.
Yeah, I think I've heard bits and pieces of the story of how you got signed. Can you kind of explain? So you recorded the record before you got signed, probably with the intention of self-releasing or something.
What had happened, from my point of view, was we had played a showcase. This is it all happened in like really quickly. It started in March, towards the middle of March, in 1997. We had a showcase at either the Roxy or the Whiskey in Hollywood. By this time, we had had something. In November of 96, we were on the cover of BAM, which was a big deal at the time. You guys know, BAM magazine was a big deal. And because of that song, we had that song, Nervous in the Alley, that was KOME was in it. It was in his top 8. She's going to a place where they understand. Baby, on the way, I want the garbage can. Who said anything about a good life? This was bad, 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 bad. Gonzo again. So the local edition, we were on the cover. That was a big deal. But that was in November, and we thought we're going to get signed for sure. We're on the cover of BAM, But then by March, nothing had happened, and we were getting like, "What the hell, man?" We're, So we had one last showcase. The being on the cover made us famous enough where we could play it like the Whiskey or the Roxy or whatever. So we played with it, and it was like all suits. It was all, like A&R people. We were in Hollywood, you know? And like Greg and Steve, I mean, not to put the blame, like, but it was true. Like just before we played, just got hammered, you know, and they were just hammered. And they make it through like three songs. They couldn't play. They just were just too hammered to play. Smashing guitars. Back up, went home to San Jose. That was that, you know. It was our last chance, band over, you know. But then a couple of weeks later, Greg Colby's like, hey, we're going to make a record. Robert, our manager, is going to give us money, and we're going to make a record just for posterity. So it was like a Polaroid picture, like a swan song. Like we're done. Like that's just, we worked so hard and we have these great songs. Let's record them just so we have something to show our friends, kind of thing, you know. Mm-hmm. But we have Eric Valentine doing it, and Robert put up the money, which I couldn't believe he did, because I thought we were done. So, well, I'm like, cool, all right. I thought the bet was over, but yeah, let's make a record, you know, for sure. So we went in and made the record in like 10 days. We did it at weird hours, you know, with Eric Valentine, though. And the thing is, we were rehearsed. When Greg and Steve weren't hammered, or all of us were hammered back then, I can't just pinpoint them. But, we were well rehearsed. So Fleshy Mang is, you know, the songs are tight because we had rehearsed them for like 2 hours. And so we were able to record that record quick. And then once we were done with it, I remember thinking, because it was a different way of recording that I was used to. And I thought there was way more to do. And then one day Eric Valentine's like, okay, you're done. That's it. I'm like, what do you mean we're done? He's like, you're done the records. You're done recording. I'm like, oh, all right. So that was it, you know. And then I didn't even think about it. So I went on a surf trip in Big Sur. And back then we didn't have cell phones. And if you're in Big Sur, you don't have like reception. I was gone for like 5 days or something. And I didn't know what was happening in the real world for those 5 days. So when I came home, I was like bumming out. I'm like, I don't have a band. My pants, you know, I'm broke. Like I'm getting old. Like this band thing didn't work out. Poor me. You know, I got to go get a job now. Work at Sizzler again or something. Oh, I'm bummed out. And I get, it's a long drive home from Big Sur. I get home. I check my answering machine. They had answering machines back then, you know, and it's just like, PD, give us a call. Then it's Steve. Then it's great. PD calls, dude. PD, you got to call us, man. You got to call us. Dude, something's happening. Then the last one is like, PD, we just signed a record deal with Interscope Records for $1 million.
Insane.
So I'm like, I couldn't get a hold of the guys. I'm like, this has got to be a joke, you know? Like, this can't be true. Because I thought the band, I hadn't heard anything. I hadn't spoken to anyone, you know? So I couldn't get a hold of Greg or Steve or Robert or management. So I called my parents in Canada to tell them, and they yelled at me. They were like, stop, you gotta stop this rock and roll nonsense and get a job. You're too old. I'm like, okay, I'll get back to you, you know?
So do you know what happened? I mean, what did they tell you happened?
Then I finally got a hold of Greg, and they're like, we got something. And those 5 days were a very adventurous 5 days. And what happened was Robert and Steve, and Greg had drove down to Hollywood by the time we knew Carson Daly, you know, from KSJO.
KOME.
KOME, yeah, KOME.
Yeah, he's from San Jose, or he got his start in San Jose.
He just gotten promoted to K-Rock in Hollywood just right around that time.
Yeah.
And so he was down at K-Rock, and we kind of knew him. So we're like, so Greg and Steve, and this is like in the very like end of May of 1997, drive down to Hollywood. And they, you know, they have some Robert, unknowns to me, the band was still much alive, like with Robert had some interest by things. And we also had the song Walking on the Sun, which we didn't, that was only recent. We only recorded that in like March. Like that was like a new song, but that kind of was a game changer. And then they had some meetings. And then one night, Carson, it was like Tuesday, at like 2 a.m. on a Tuesday, and he could do this thing called Pick of the Week, where he can play whatever he wanted. And it was 2 a.m, it was K-Rock, and he played Walking on the Sun. And the like they say, the old story goes, the phones lit up. It was like a classic thing. And the next day, literally that the hours later, in like 8 a.m, every label that had blown Robert off and said, go out, you must, every single major label was because they played it. They put it in rotation. They got so many requests, like, and we were unsigned. So the next day, our managers just flooded with every label is offering him a deal, you know. And I'm sitting in Big Sur, you know, I don't know, you know, smoking a hookah and, you know, going spearfishing or whatever, you know. And then it turns out that Interscope or someone, or he had a, I don't know how Interscope, but they felt like Interscope was the best fit. And it was, really. And it wasn't the most money earning, but they, a few days later, they, you know, they drove down there with just a still warm CD of our new album. He played Walking on the Sun like once at 2 a.m. And the next night or something, we had this record deal for like $2 million. It was crazy. But when they say that much money, it's not really that much money, but you know, you don't get.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's just a number, but it sure did, you know, I didn't believe it was real, you know, and they came and it was just amazing that this happened in those days. And they were just waiting for me to get home. And I got home and I'm like, I didn't believe it. You know, I'm like, this is because we were used to being poor and like, you know, and then a couple days later in the mail, literally, I got a check that looked like a publisher's clearinghouse fake check or something, you know, but it wasn't fake. It was real. And it was for like $30,000. It was like for me, like for, and then I'm like, this is a fake check. And I took it to the bank and it wasn't fake. They called me Mr. Delisle, you know, and I got to sit at a desk, you know, with, you know, real adults sit at, you know, and that's, you know, that was for me, it was like, I was a freaking millionaire. Like, I'm like, I could live off this for like 5 years, you know?
The story, as I understand it, about Walking on the Sun. Now, the whole record, the whole first record is ska punk. I mean, there's songs on there that's like fast, like really, really fast punk. So Walking on the Sun doesn't sound like any other record, any other song on that record.
See, that's, and it was the last one. And that's the other thing is like, people don't believe us. Said we didn't really have rules for what it had to be. It wasn't like, it didn't have to be a certain style. At first, Walking on the Sun was more like almost a disc. It was kind of like, it ain't no joke, I like to buy. We had that kind of beat, like, and we when we slowed it down with the ride symbol, we gave it kind of a Ramsey Lewis feel. We always kind of liked that Escovel and like sort of Martin Denny sort of bachelor pad kind of music thing, or like Ramsey Lewis 60s kind of thing, you know. So we thought that would be cool just to do it, but we certainly didn't think, I certainly didn't think it was going to be a you know, a big of a hit. I thought it sounded cool and everything, but here's how much of an idiot I am. When we were voting like what songs to put on the album, I said, I don't think we should put that on the album. It doesn't sound like the other songs. I'm glad I got outvoted, but you're right. It doesn't.
So as I understand it, Greg had written that song before Smash Mouth for a different band. And that prior band.
Yeah. He'd had it on a cassette for a long time. You know, by that time we were really in the groove for writing songs, you know, and Greg was the main songwriter for sure. And his songs were getting better. And we were the right guys to be able to execute them, especially, you know, Greg and I were very productive. It was a very satisfying partnership. You know, he was the best guy I've ever, like, just, he was such a good writer. And I was a songwriter too. And everything we were doing was working. And it was cool. Like, I've been working towards it for so long. And then you never think it's, you know, that I never thought we were going to get famous or anything. I believed in Greg's in my songs, you know, like it was really fun. I was really, at that point, I was really into it, you know, it seemed like it was kind of peaking because we rehearsed so much.
So I'm also curious about the other song that did get some MTV play and stuff was, Why Can't We Be Friends?
Why can't we be friends? Why can't we be friends? Why can't we be friends? Why can't we be friends?
Yeah, you know who plays horns on that? You remember the band Monkey? Remember Monkey?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That's the monkey horn section.
Wow, I never knew that.
Wow.
They play on Disconnect the Dots on a thing. Like, if there's horns, it's the monkey horn section. They're great.
Yeah. Who do you remember whose idea it was to cover that song, and also who decided to give it that sort of ska treatment to it?
That was kind of Olivar's idea. I remember we did it. No one asked us to do it. See, the thing about Fush You Mang, people have to remember, is when we made Fush You Mang, like the album that you hear, we weren't signed. Robert paid for it. It was an independent, there was no label pressure, nothing. They bought the record, Robert had already paid, so we could do whatever we wanted. And that one worked well live. In the ska treatment of it, we thought, well, it's kind of a reggae song, and any reggae song can be made a ska song. And when we rehearsed it, it sounded really good, so we kept it. That was kind of like a live thing, you know?
Now, you guys have several covers that have gotten really, really famous over the years. Is that the first cover you guys ever did?
Let's see. No, it wasn't the first cover we ever did. The first cover we ever did was Every Word Means No by a band called Let's Active, whose leader was Mitch Easter, who produced the early REM albums.
Okay.
You remember Mitch Easter? He was like associated with, and Let's Active was kind of hip in the very early 80s, kind of attached to the Paisley Underground thing.
Mm, okay.
From this, you know, and then the song Every Word Means No. Every Word Means No. And Greg and I thought it was a cool song. So that was the first one. And it's actually on the East Bay sessions.
Was there ska on that one? I can't remember.
No, that one's just like straight up, like the Plimsolls, like power pop.
Okay.
Do you guys remember the Plimsolls, the band the Plimsolls?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Remember them?
Yeah.
I loved them.
So we can kind of say Walking on the Sun basically got you guys signed, essentially, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Then Interscope just bought the album, and like they were like, I remember going down there and being in these offices in like Beverly Hills, and like, what the hell am I doing? You know, and I remember Robert saying to me, like, when we're flying down there, he's like, Paul, don't say anything, all right? Like, don't talk so much.
Oh, I was also reading that Greg, when he wrote that song years earlier, he was writing in response to the LA riots. Kind of a like, you know, why can't we all get along esque like sort of song. Is that what you recall?
It's part of Greg's arsenal. Is like he'll have it's almost like a folk song or something. He's such a great songwriter. He's one of the great, you know, living American songwriters. But every now and then he'll have like a little bit of a rant. Another one is like, let me see, I can't think of it all. But it's a style that he writes. But that one's very wordy, but the groove of it and the chorus, it was so different from what was happening at the time that it was like the anti-grunge.
Yeah, it was. And like, yeah, like you said, like the chorus is very wordy.
It's not traditional at all, you know, and nothing really changes in the song. It's just like a one, you know, pattern throughout.
I also read, I think it was in a Reddit Ask Me Anything thing that you did, where you said that your favorite bass line that you've ever played on Smash Mouth was Walking on the Sun.
Well, yeah, it's a neat bass line because it's a hammer-on, you know, what that is, where like you play a note and then you play the other note with your finger. So it's like, dum, instead of playing two notes. And then it's the song's kind of all bass, really, you know?
Yeah.
In fact, the whole album is.
Hey, best thing, right?
And this is like, all Greg's doing is going, tick, 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 tick. I'm doing all the work. I'm like, do, 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 do.
That song, I remember that song played everywhere for like 2 years. It was just all over the place, yeah.
It was weird. It was a massive hit, and it wouldn't go away. You know, and it was strange because when you have a hit like that, you keep doing press. Like we just stayed on tour. We didn't go home for like we went out on tour in July of '97. Right when it hit, we made a video. And we went on tour. It was going to be like 6 weeks with Sugar Ray. That turned into like 13 months. Like we were literally, we'd be home for like a few days or like a couple of days. Then we'd be back on tour so long that, like, because the song wouldn't, like, it was still a hit. Like, you have to stay out there. And, like, as long, you know, like, it's still popular. And And so it just hung around forever, you know. It was weird. It was like very, very strange, you know. It just kind of it just changes your life, you know.
After that, was there any thought about, you know, you guys kind of came from basically playing punk and punk ska, like that you guys really didn't stay there at all. Like in the next, was there any thought behind that?
That's the thing. We want, Greg and I knew that, Greg and I were basically the music, Greg and I were the musical directors. I mean, Kevin and Steve did what they were, and this is to their credit. Kevin and Steve knew that Greg and I had more experience, and they pretty much did what we told them to do. So Greg and I were just kind of doing what we liked or what we wanted to, like Greg would write, here's a song I wrote. Cool. I like it. Let's play it. You know, it was kind of like that. We didn't really, you know, have a game plan so much as just to make good songs. It was came down to, is your song good enough or not? You know, we were trying to make pops, like really catchy, good songs. And Greg was just so good at it. You know, what happened, I think, with this Scott thing was there wasn't so much of on it on the second album, if any, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I remember Greg saying, and Greg was smart because we were on a bus for literally 13 months. And he had a little, four track or something in the back lounge where he started working on the next album very early on. And I remember him saying, because, you know, we'd never been on long tours like this before. And you're right. Everything on Freshman Being is fast. And even though we were only playing your first album, you play opening slots. So only have 45 minutes. I remember Greg going, man, this shit is hard to play live. The next album is going to be slower because I'm sick. I don't want to play this fashion every night. So it's, that's why the second album slowed down. He's like, man, this shit's too hard to play every night. I'm going to slow it down for the next record.
So having a big single is cool, but is it also being a new band, having one song that's played constantly and then going in to record your second record, did you feel pressure at all?
Oh, absolutely. But it's the greatest. It was the greatest thing in the world. It was shocking for me and a little bit scary because I didn't think it was going to. I wasn't one of those dudes that was like, I told your mom and dad I was going to be. I told you I was going to make it. I was like, I'm as shocked as you are. You know, I wasn't expecting. You know. And it's really life changing, and it really is like there's so much attached to it. It was such a big hit that all of a sudden you have this key to this other world, man. Doors open up that you never open, and mm-hmm. It's really exciting and really, really fun and glamorous and all of that. You know, it's a great ride, but you know that it's going to, you have another record to make, but we had already been working on the second record. We had on the road. So we were still on the music thing. And the other thing is you have to understand there was not so much internet back then. And there wasn't so much so when you're on a bus, you're kind of in a cocoon. We kind of know what's happening, but we don't really know. We're not really in the real world. It's not till we get home or to understand how big it really was. You know, we're selling a couple million records and MTV all the time. It took a while to sink in. At least it did for me, you know.
It's interesting because you guys have gone on to have much bigger song, or you've had your career has only grown from then. So, but you did a reissue, I believe, of a Fushu Meng, in late 2023, right, on vinyl, and it was in honor of Steve as well, right?
Yeah, and I think we did that earlier where we did an acoustic version of it that Deegan here again did, which I thought was kind of a cool idea. Mm-hmm. I don't know if slowing down, I don't know whose idea it was to slow down the song. That might have been Steve to slow down, but some of it seems a little draggy to me. But it's very well recorded, and it's a nice different version of that record.
Do you hear from fans much about this record? I mean, I when I look online, I see every once in a while a fan will be like, "That's the record, that's the record."
Yeah, people request Padrino a lot. We got to add that to the set list. I'm a man of respect, and I'm a part of the Atlanta Padrino.
Yeah, that's a great song, a great ska song. Let's bring Padrino back in the set list.
I want to do that one. That's a really well-written song too.
It's like it's the only album you guys have ever done, though, that where you guys were not famous and you were not signed to a label. So it's a totally different context than everything else you've ever done.
And, you know, it's funny now that you mention it, doing the second record, I didn't feel that much. Well, I did. Of course, we felt pressure, but I thought once we got a couple songs recorded, like the first one recorded was Dig In Your Scene. And we were back with Eric at the same studio. So that was familiar. And we'd been playing every night. So we were playing better, like and we just kept doing what we'd been doing. And I felt pretty confident that we were going to be okay. So it wasn't until we delivered the record, and they went, we don't hear a single. And Greg went back and wrote Then the Morning Comes and All Star.
Here's two singles.
There you go. And it was the same. That studio was right there in Redwood City. So many things were recorded there. Like all the first Third Eye Blind album, Citizen King's record, which is great. Dean's making a ton of noise over here. Yeah. So we were comfortable and it felt, you know, like it wasn't, we had this place up in at the summit between San Jose and Santa Cruz that Robert, our manager, rented this house for us out in the middle of nowhere so we could play as loud as we wanted, you know. And that's where we did the second record when we got off tour. And it only took us a couple months. We were just in musical shape, and Greg had the songs, and we, you know, we got them together pretty quickly, and we were lucky. It was pretty painless. And then everyone thought we was a one hit wonder, but that record was, you know, the one that was our crown jewel, you know.
Thank you for listening to In Defense of Ska. To support the show, sign up for our Patreon. Intro and outro music by Slow Gherkin from the EP Lives. Additional music by Dan P. and the Bricks. Please rate and review the podcast and tell a friend. Follow at In Defense of Ska on social media. The book In Defense of Ska by Aaron Carnes is available from Clash Books. Order it online. Chris Reeves of SPI is our editor. This is your co-host, Adam Davis of Omnigon, leaving you by saying ska now more than ever.
Somebody once told me that Aaron Carnes my homie, and he's gonna tell you about Patreon.
All right. You just listened to us talk to Smash Mouth bassist Paul DeLisle, and we talked about the early years. We talked about the first record, but you know what we didn't really talk about much?
What's that?
The song you just sang, All Star.
Yeah.
But you know where we did talk about it?
Behind the Curtain.
Behind the Curtain, yes.
Well, you know what else we talked to him about, which I thought was real bold? We brought up the meme versions of the song.
Yes. What does he think of the meme versions? You got to listen. You got to sign up and listen and find out. It's wow. It'll blow your mind.
It'll blow your mind.
All right. Get to it.
Hey, folks. Once a month, our Patreon subscribers get a brand new bonus episode. These bonus episodes are completely different from our usual content. Here's a sample of the conversation we have waiting for you on our Patreon this month.
So over the life of the podcast, who continues to be like any white whales that you haven't gotten a chance to talk to yet, or maybe somebody that turned you down that you really wish they said yes?
I don't really get turned down so much as no replies. I honestly would still love to get anyone from No Doubt to come on the podcast. I've actually really been after Eric Stefani. That's kind of like, that's the member I'd really like, because he was the one that started the band. He was the one that envisioned the band, and he was pretty much the leader of the band up until the point he quit, which was partway through Tragic Kingdom. And he was the ska guy. You know, he was all about ska. So he's a big one. Eric Andre. Why not Eric Idle? I don't know. Let's have him come on too.
To get access to this episode and all of our exclusive backer content, go sign up for our Patreon today. That's patreon.com/indefensiveska. Ska now, more than ever.
Taxes was feeling so stuck. Sitting in traffic, squeezing into a parking spot, all to squeeze in getting tax help during your lunch break. Now Taxes is a TurboTax expert who does your taxes for you, while you go about your day getting real-time notifications about their progress and the most money back guaranteed. Now this is Taxes, Intuit TurboTax. Get an expert now on TurboTax.com. Only available with TurboTax Live Full Service, real-time updates only in iOS mobile apps. See guarantee details at TurboTax.com/guarantees.
Big shout out to you for making it through the hectic holiday season. This new year, get clean, quality, pregnancy nutrient support off your to-do list, including Ritual's best-selling Essential Prenatal Multivitamin, designed with 12 traceable key ingredients to support a healthy pregnancy. With big changes coming up, take the small steps now and start today with 30% off a 3-month supply at ritual.com/podcast. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.